Cambridge Certificate of Proficiency in English Listening Test. Test 2.
I'm going to give you the instructions for this test. I'll introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you'll hear this sound. You'll hear each piece twice. Remember, while you're listening, write your answers on the question paper. You'll have 5 minutes at the end of the test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. There'll now be a pause. Please ask any questions now because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You'll hear four different extracts. For questions 1 to 8, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are two questions for each extract. Extract 1.
How many of us can put our hands on our hearts and say we've never blown our top, cast caution aside, and let rip in that most exquisite spasm of apoplexy, temper? Oh, we've all heard about road rage, trolley rage, you name it rage, that burning frustration threatening to explode as you wait for the shopkeeper to finish her conversation before she serves you. But despite living in a culture that positively encourages us to let it all hang out, a few of us still don't like to admit that we lose our temper. But we've all been there. Certainly as children, the stamping feet, the clenched fists, wails of fury. But as adults, well, that's a different story. Have you ever caught sight of yourself in the mirror while in the throes of a rage? The bright red face, the huffing and puffing. When we've calmed down, we realise it's an ever so slightly undignified episode, which most of us would like to forget and quite often do. Not that that stops us falling into the trap again. How many of us can put our hands on our hearts and say we've never blown our top, cast caution aside, and let rip in that most exquisite spasm of apoplexy, temper? Oh, we've all heard about road rage, trolley rage, you name it rage, that burning frustration threatening to explode as you wait for the shopkeeper to finish her conversation before she serves you. But despite living in a culture that positively encourages us to let it all hang out, a few of us still don't like to admit that we lose our temper. But we've all been there. Certainly as children, the stamping feet, the clenched fists, wails of fury. But as adults, well, that's a different story. Have you ever caught sight of yourself in the mirror while in the throes of a rage? The bright red face, the huffing and puffing. When we've calmed down, we realise it's an ever so slightly undignified episode, which most of us would like to forget and quite often do. Not that that stops us falling into the trap again.
Extract 2.
Michael, do you think autobiography is a less honest form than biography?
I think it's more personal but less comprehensive. It's probably better at getting at certain aspects of the truth, childhood, relationship with parents and...
But the problem arises, Michael, when people have an image they wish to protect. Politicians, for example, rock stars and sports performers.
Well, my view is, wherever facts are in dispute, trust the biography.
Mm-hmm.
I think public figures, their autobiographies, often give themselves away inadvertently, but are not to be relied on wholly.
Now, you've had the experience of helping a rock star, Frank Silva, write his autobiography. What was that like?
Well, Frank has a streak of honesty, rare perhaps in his line of work. It's almost a perverse masochistic wish to be straight in the face of his image, and that, in a sense, is his image. When we started, Frank told me to go to Scotland and check what he remembered with his relatives.
Uh-huh.
I said, we don't need that. The whole point about an autobiography is it's your view of what happened that people are interested in, and it becomes a self-validating process.
Michael, do you think autobiography is a less honest form than biography?
I think it's more personal but less comprehensive. It's probably better at getting at certain aspects of the truth, childhood, relationship with parents and...
But the problem arises, Michael, when people have an image they wish to protect. Politicians, for example, rock stars and sports performers.
Well, my view is, wherever facts are in dispute, trust the biography.
Mm-hmm.
I think public figures, their autobiographies, often give themselves away inadvertently, but are not to be relied on wholly.
Now, you've had the experience of helping a rock star, Frank Silver, write his autobiography. What was that like?
Well, Frank has a streak of honesty, rare perhaps in his line of work. It's almost a perverse masochistic wish to be straight in the face of his image, and that, in a sense, is his image. When we started, Frank told me to go to Scotland and check what he remembered with his relatives.
Uh-huh.
I said, we don't need that. The whole point about an autobiography is it's your view of what happened that people are interested in, and it becomes a self-validating process.
Extract 3. What's
likely to happen all over the world is that we'll see an increasing homogenization of the Earth's plant life. There's plenty of evidence to show that that's going on. I'm particularly worried about aliens, plants that have insinuated themselves into ecosystems where they don't belong. Many ecologists now believe that the spread of such aliens is the second biggest threat to the world's range of species after habitat loss. A lot of the species we're talking about that are currently causing this problem were deliberately brought in for ornamentation. But once aliens are established, it's not easy to get rid of them. They become a problem not because native ones are effete and ripe for takeover by more aggressive colonists, but because native plants have their own predators, insects, etc., fungal diseases. When you have an introduction into a country, it doesn't have anything that's adapted to live on it. And so the alien is able to grow very well with a release from that competition, I suppose. What's likely to happen all over the world is that we'll see an increasing homogenization of the Earth's plant life. There's plenty of evidence to show that that's going on. I'm particularly worried about aliens. Plants that have insinuated themselves into ecosystems where they don't belong. Many ecologists now believe that the spread of such aliens is the second biggest threat to the world's range of species after habitat loss. A lot of the species we're talking about that are currently causing this problem were deliberately brought in for ornamentation. But once aliens are established, it's not easy to get rid of them. They become a problem not because native ones are effete and ripe for takeover by more aggressive colonists, but because native plants have their own predators, insects, etc., fungal diseases. When you have an introduction into a country, it doesn't have anything that's adapted to live on it. And so the alien is able to grow very well with a release from that competition, I suppose.
Extract 4.
The next time some academic writes a book about how science is on the verge of having a grand theory of everything, he or she should be mercilessly exposed, not only for misleading us, but for encouraging us to believe that science has the answer to all our problems. That all we need to do is lie back and follow the instructions. Genetics is the most recent example of this triumphalism in science. Exaggerated news reports give the impression that a genetic cause can be assigned to virtually anything. And whilst more serious scientists make clear that that's not true, if you study the evidence carefully, no one's listening at that point because the story's broken and the headline has caught the public imagination in a way that the detail never could. The cult of the expert is a strong one. We like to believe that scientists are clever and their conclusions are valid, but we also persuade ourselves that we don't need to think things through for ourselves. Somebody else will do this for us, somebody who knows what they're talking about. The next time some academic writes a book about how science is on the verge of having a grand theory of everything, he or she should be mercilessly exposed, not only for misleading us, but for encouraging us to believe that science has the answer to all our problems. That all we need to do is lie back and follow the instructions. Genetics is the most recent example of this triumphalism in science. Exaggerated news reports give the impression that a genetic cause can be assigned to virtually anything. And whilst more serious scientists make clear that that's not true, if you study the evidence carefully, no one's listening at that point because the story's broken and the headline has caught the public imagination in a way that the detail never could. The cult of the expert is a strong one. We like to believe that scientists are clever and their conclusions are valid, but we also persuade ourselves that we don't need to think things through for ourselves. Somebody else will do this for us, somebody who knows what they're talking about.
That's the end of part one.